Okay. Today we'll be speaking with Saul Zabar from Zabar's in New York City.
Right.
You've already told us a little bit about the history of Zabar's. Your father had 10 markets in New York before it became solidly Zabar's. How did he start those, and why is it only one rather than a lot of Zabar's?
Well, when he came to this country in the 1920s, he came from a family that was a business family. They came from a town called Ostropolia. And I don't know how many thousand people were there and how many Jews, but it wasn't a big place. And he went to the Cheder in Ostropolia, and then eventually went to Odessa. The family sent to Odessa to go to gymnasium because they didn't have this stuff. And then he had to come back in 1919 when the revolution was taking place. 1919, 1920, they ought to come back because the revolution was in the middle of itself. Mm-hmm. And the revolution didn't get finished until 1923 or so, until they chased the British out of Russia. But that's another story. And so his family were business people. My mother's family ran a tavern, drinking food, and my father's family ran a business of lumber and dried nuts and fruits, dried fruits and nuts, and they would buy things and then resell them. I'm not too, but I just know that part. So he had worked, so he came from a business background. So when he came to this country, he realized he didn't want to work for anybody. So he immediately, he had some relatives here. He came in illegally into the country from he walked across the border into Detroit, and he had a relative in Detroit that he stayed with, and then he came down to New York, to Brooklyn, and he had a stall in a farmer's market. Zion's, called Zion's Market, because I knew Mr. Zion afterwards, because they were partners in certain respect afterwards, and he sold produce. And then he got into smoked fish, and then found my mother. They married. I was born in 28. I think they married in 26 or 27. And there was a series of mom and pop stores, and then he came to Broadway from King's Highway, and he was originally in King's Highway, and then he came to New York. And leased a small department in what was then a Deitch store. The Deitch was a well-known dairy chain in those days, family-owned. And he leased it, but a relative of the Deitch had opened a small supermarket on this block, and somehow he was brought to him, and he leased the smokefish department. And then, for whatever reason, the owner decided he wanted to sell, and so my father then acquired the entire market, and that was still during the Depression. It was before the war. It was. I think he must have gotten into this thing. We're here since 34. Must have been 36, 37, 38. But this neighborhood was fairly affluent, and it provided. And they made a very good living. They had to work hard. He worked in the store. My mother worked in the store, and they made a very good living. Then during the war, He opened a store at Broadway and 110th Street, a store at 96th Street, a little deli at 96th Street, a real store at 110th, a little deli at 96th. He had a little store he bought out from someone that he wanted to come to work for him, so he had to buy out the store at 92nd Street, and then he had Zabar's, and then he was in partner with a gentleman called Aaron Klein, which was related to my future partner, Murray Klein, who became a partner here. I forget how many years ago, it had to be 40 years ago, became a partner. And he was related to Aaron Klein. But anyway, Aaron was my father's partner, and my father brought him up as sort of a second son. Aaron built markets, so they had some markets on the east side. They had one on Amsterdam Avenue with an Israeli partner. And so it was a whole slew of stores. When he died in 1950, at the age of 49, basically he owned all of the Broadway stores, which I've just enumerated, so about four of them. And Klein The deal was that Klein then retained the East Side stores, which there were probably three or four of those. And so that, and then when I came into, when he died in 1950, when I was 21 years of age, so I came into the business. I was in the middle of college, so I left school. I came here to be some help to my mother because she had a, my brother Eli is my wife's age. So he had to be, I think, 8 or 9 at that time. Probably had to be, I was young. So I came here to be of some help. And I stayed. And I got married. And I tried to run these stores here. And I was not too successful. Mm-hmm. I really didn't have the training or the background because I had never done it. I mean, I used to help my father on a Sunday because we had what they called the Blue Laws.
Yeah.
In those days, they had the Blue Laws. And it, when there were, whatever the laws were, you could be open from 9 to 11 in the morning and 4 to 7 in the afternoon, and you were limited in what you could sell. Whether they were church-related or however they came to being, I have no idea, but those are blue laws. So I had, my brother and I, Stanley, who's 4 years younger, we came down on Sundays to help fill in the holes because we couldn't have people coming in at 9 in the morning and staying till 7, 8 at night, you know, so on. So we helped out. That was my only training. Mm-hmm. I really didn't do, except on Saturdays, I may have delivered orders, but I really didn't have any background. And then I went through high school, and I went to college, and then I came back suddenly, and here I had these stores, and I really didn't have any background for it. Mm-hmm. And Stanley was going to school at that time. He was in the middle of his University of Pennsylvania. He was going to the Wharton School, and then he worked part-time with me, and then he went on to Brooklyn Law. And so he continued to go to school while both of us were here. But I was a full-time person. And after 8 years of this, I realized that I was not going to be successful. I just didn't have the background, knowledge, personality. So the other stores were liquidated, and this store remained, Zabar's.
Uh-huh.
And I was attempting to sell it when Murray Klein, my future partner, came on the scene. He had been a manager for me in a very nice store we had at Broadway and 96th Street called Sells Market, and he had left to go into his own business in the hardware business. But he had sold his hardware store. He had a small hardware store. He sold it. He was walking by. I invited him back into the business, and he eventually became a partner, and he ran Zabar's with an iron fist. And then Zabar's became successful. Because I knew the product then, I knew everything to know about product and quality, but he was an operational man. He was personnel, he was finances, he was a very good partner. A difficult partner because his personality, a very difficult personality to live with, but a very good partner in the sense he was honest, he was hardworking, mm-hmm. but he's very difficult personality. His personality was difficult, but he had a lot of good other attributes, and it made for a very, very successful combination. With I was doing the perishables, I was doing coffee. At that time, we were selling 10 to 11,000 pounds a week because we were the only one in town that was roasting and doing that gourmet, so-called gourmet coffee. It became caught on, and I see that every bodega and every supermarket has of any size has a bean coffee department,
sure.
and so forth. We still continue to roast it. The way we did, we don't have our own facility. We use a trade roaster, someone who roasts for the trade, and we buy our own coffee. And behind you is a coffee table. It's a Lazy Susan where the entire table rotates, so you can sample coffee. And you've seen our video on the blog,
right.
You've seen the blog, our video on our website. It's essentially, I mean, it's really truncated.
Well, who taught you those skills of the quality, the taste, and everything like that?
That's another story. When I was interested in the coffee and was looking around for places to be able to buy it, and the only source that I could find was a roaster in California that was in Monterey, I think, that was doing the same kind of thing that I thought we should be doing. And it became too big a job to ship the product, roasted product from them, because by the time we got it, it was 4 or 5 days old, because they had to go by truck and so forth. So somehow we made a connection with a company called White Coffee Company. The White Coffee Company. And the senior, the founder of the coffee, had been a salesman working for his brother-in-law and had financed this coffee roasting operation. And I'm trying to remember how I came in contact with him, but he was glad to have us as a customer, and it was agreed that I would select the coffees with his help, of course, but he would own everything in his plant, and he began to train me and teach me. I was there every day, many hours, cupping, training, teaching, because as I say, he was retired, his son was running the business, and he really needed an acolyte. Mm-hmm. So I became his sidekick and spent several years there tasting, sampling, studying under him, learning under him, whatever you want to call it, until I left that company and moved on. I separated myself from them and I moved on to a company that had just recently moved to Brooklyn to 3rd Avenue, 3rd Street. And they were trade roasters only. The White Coffee Company was roasting Zabar's coffee, but they were selling to restaurants. Their business was restaurants.
Right.
And so they subsequently became one of the largest, they are probably the largest gourmet coffee roasters supplying all of New York. I mean, they really grew after I left. Mm. I think they followed our model. They learned, they had no idea when I came there that this is what they were going to be doing 3 or 4 years hence. But once they saw what we were doing, Zabar's, and they realized that this was really a very fertile area, it didn't require any more expense on their part to turn it into a gourmet bean coffee supplier. Mm-hmm. They just had to get their clients to, their customers to understand what's going on.
Sure.
So we left them. We went to 3rd Avenue, 3rd Street, Harry Wolf and Sons. I just moved there from Front Street. The New York City, in its infinite wisdom, had destroyed the coffee area on Front Street on the East River, and built and had allowed the high-rise buildings to go up. They almost allowed the area for the fish market outside the fish market to be destroyed. But somehow, there's a couple of streets that were saved with the old buildings. You've seen it,
yeah.
Old buildings so far. They had no idea in those days that these were really things that should have been preserved historically and so forth.
Even the Fulton Fish Market, I think, should have been preserved in some way.
Well, I guess so. But around the Fulton Fish Market, there were the old buildings.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's one street, I forget the name of the street, that has all the buildings, you know, facing each other,
yeah.
Going back to the 1700s, 1800s.
Yeah.
There isn't much left.
Yeah.
And they're all facades now because the inside had turned into boutiques and
sure.
So forth. But the New York City allowed the coffee district to be decimated by developers. It should have been made into a historic district, but it couldn't do it because the people owned the properties were sold to
sure.
The highest bidder. So what had been a coffee area where coffee merchants were, importers, where boats actually used to come right up into the wharf, right up into the piers. And the brokers would go aboard the boats to sample the coffee that on these sailing vessels. Actually, sailing vessels were bringing stuff here. And so, and there's one kind of coffee that's called monsoon coffee, where the coffee is sent around the world to go through. The coffee changes when it's subject to the heat and the humidity that's in the hold of a sailing vessel. It changes in its character, so, and it's called monsoon coffee. Usually, Colombians would know that's what. And we bought some in previous years. It's still being done, I think. But now it's in the hold of freighters, you know, big
sure.
ships. Yeah. So anyway, so then I found myself with Harry Wolf and Sons, who had just moved. They were glad to see me. And they kept my coffee. I would buy coffee and they would store it. They had two stores. They had a main floor, which was for packaging and for canning. We used to get some of those cans up there, the white labels, they back to that company. And they had a canning line, they had vacuuming, they had pouches, they had all the whole thing. And that was the main floor, the second or third floor for storing customers' coffee. and the fourth floor was the second floor were offices. I'm sorry, second floor were offices. The third and fourth was grocery stores, and the fifth floor was the roasting floor. And I would go there every day, every time our corn was roasting, and I would be there with them. And we had some other dealers that were in the same area, so they were also my professors. I mean, Coffee Holding, which is a major company now run by the children, was a small company then, and I would. They were all the teachers, you know, all professors of mine. Yeah, so that's how we learned the coffee business. And dealt with many of the coffee brokers and porters, so forth, and we saw a lot of coffee of different kinds, because being in a warehouse, in a production like that, you see a lot of other people's coffee flowing through, stuff that I would never buy.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting, the type of robustas, which we don't use, but not robustas, and all the coffees from every portion, every edge of the world. We had Tanzanian pea berries. I mean, we saw everything, and it was a wonderful education.
Sure.
Now I only see top of the line coffee. I only see the best, that 10% or 20%. That's the top of the line. So I never see any of that middle and low level stuff, which I used to see because they had a community sample roasting area. They had a machine like this that had five cylinders.
Right.
And the people who were using, some of the people who were using the facility would come down and roast their own samples, and they would, so it was an education. That's everything. This is a long story.
Yeah.
For coffee. But anyway, so at that time we were doing 10 or 11,000 pounds of coffee a week. With a 16% loss, you're talking about 12, 13,000 pounds. A bag of coffee is 152 pounds. For the most part, some countries it's 130, it's 131, 132. But the Central American coffee is coming up. So we were roasting about 10,000 pounds of coffee a week. Now we do about 7,000. And the reason we dropped the business is that every corner grocery has a coffee, a bean coffee department.
Starbucks.
Fairway has it. Well, from the Fairway, from the bodegas, everybody has that kind of coffee. So we do now about 7,000. We ship out about 2,000 pounds of coffee a week that we send to our website and through old customers that we send to.
But you, I guess, were the catalyst to get all this coffee drinking going.
We were the originators. And then, of course, an organization came along, the SCA, that's called the Specialty Coffee Association.
Mm-hmm.
So we were at the beginnings of the foundation of that group. And now it's a huge group. We started with 10, 15 members. Now there could be 5,000 members all over the country. There's all kinds of boutique roasters.
Sure.
Throughout, you probably are not aware of them, but there's people who are in love with coffee and they have a small roasting machine. They have little shops, not so much in New York City.
Yeah.
You have a couple of those now. You have Orange Roast, I think, is on the side. There's a few of those.
We actually have a small. I think there are Armenians in our neighborhood that they have a roasting machine at their place as well.
Yeah. But there are other places, particularly in California.
Mm.
They have a lot of these boutique roasters with small machines, getting very exotic coffees from auctions. There are auctions where people pay $10 and $20 a pound for the green coffee. So here and this screen over here is my access to the coffee futures market. So it's I'm plugged into the code. That's the only thing, the only computer that I have that works. That's just for the coffee market.
Yeah.
The rest of the computing is done by the people here.
I've been kind of concerned about what's happening to, like, ethnic, the old Italian neighborhoods, the Jewish neighborhoods. It seems like they're diminishing the neighborhoods and the type of food that you're kind of used to as a New York icon. Why do you think we're losing those old Jewish delis, those places? Is there something wrong with the food, or people just don't want to have that anymore?
Well, essentially, the people that operated those stores no longer can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they've grown older. Their children, unless they were, a good many of their children have gone on to become doctors, dentists, lawyers, and chefs.
Not too many.
And the parents and the older people, there are a few that remain. I know I read something in Jersey City. There's the son carries on and the butchering and so forth. It was a labor-intensive business that demanded long hours, And while their food may have been good and it didn't have to go directly, specifically to Italians or Armenians, the people that were running it were running out of steam. I mean, they were dying, and the children were moving in other directions and marrying and going in different directions.
Do you think there's still a demand, though, for Jewish food, you know, that staple?
Well, I don't know if there's such a thing as Jewish food. I don't think there is such a thing as Jewish food except for chicken soup.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my mother, let's say my mother, made chicken soup. She'd make pot roast, which we make, pot roast, which is brisket, basically. She made good blintzes, which I never was a blintzes fan, but we do sell blintzes here, which are good. What else did she make? She made salmon croquettes. We're big for lunch. She made cookies. She was limited in her, I don't know if there's such a thing as Jewish cooking.
Yeah.
It's
well, I meant more maybe like delicatessens, the really,
Now, when I was a kid growing up here, there used to be a delicatessen on every other block.
Yeah.
You'd have a hot dog, you'd get sandwiches and so forth. Now we have only one, it's Artie's over here. The reason we only have one is that those people died out.
Sure.
And their kids did not want to provide the long hours to do it, to do what their parents were willing to do. Because the parents came here without anything, and then once they found their way to make a living, they just continued in that way.
Yeah.
So we lost the delis. We've lost the Chinese restaurants.
Yeah.
We used to have a Chinese restaurant every third block. They're gone.
Yeah.
We have one Ollie's, which is very fair, used to be good when they opened it. It was superb. And then Artie Kotler, who was the main, he was the mover and shaker. There was a gentleman named Artie Kotler, and he had an idea. He owned Murray's Sturgeon Shop.
Mm.
He had bought it from, I think, the original Murray's. And he'd come out of an economic background. And he had an idea that he would open restaurants, and the people that would be the partners, the one that he opened the restaurants with would have to be a working partner.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they began to open these various restaurants, so then they would bring in the other partners and the other ones, they would allow them to buy in to the restaurants he was opening up. And since they were with working partners, and they were very smart, these guys, they were all successful. Docs, Carmine's, Ollie's, Gabriella's, these are all restaurants that you may not recognize, but these are all spawned by Artie Kotler. And in each restaurant, they would have the operational person, and then they would have the investing partners from the other restaurants. Mm-hmm. So everybody was interconnected with this, and they were all concerned about what everybody else was doing in terms of maintaining the restaurants. Well, Artie Kotler died suddenly, I don't know, it must have been 10 years ago, and so the restaurants ceased to open, and some of them were sold. Docs was sold, Carmine's, I think, was sold, so forth and so on. So that, and then Ollie's, which was very good, become very mediocre. But I understand, my sister-in-law tells me that the chef from this Ollie's went down to 64th Street, where there's another Ollie's, so that the food there is still
better quality
than we have here.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, I was thinking more in line like Bernstein's down in Essex Street at the Katz's and all those really, iconic places, because you guys are really the last iconic...
Katz is essentially, from what I know, I haven't been there in years, but basically you get big sandwiches.
Yeah.
Katz is primarily these hand-cut sandwiches.
I don't
know what else you can get there.
Well, in Westport, where I grew up, I remember my brother worked at Gold's Delicatessen, and Julius Gold was like the real icon there, and those were like my memories of real Jewish food, because we came from Europe, so I didn't really know this food.
You had matzah brat, you had potted meatballs.
And the tongue in the barrels.
and so forth. Briskets, corned beef briskets, that are cured in the barrels and so forth.
Yeah.
Pastrami, corned beef,
Because you guys are a really a neighborhood in itself. I mean, you guys are Zabar's. That's your brand. And for me, I remember when I first started coming to the store, was like, wow, this place is like, it's huge. But it wasn't. It's just a small little store in its own sort of way. But it's really important to have that kind of stamp that it's still family owned. It's still, you know. So I kind of feel like sad that those little places are gone. That mom and pop isn't there.
They couldn't survive. Could not survive. We made the leap because you had two brothers, one a Wharton School graduate, a lawyer, practically a master's in taxation and finance. You had another one like myself, who happened to like, who had never trained for any, was a pre-med student, and never went back to it, but was a fanatic, you know, had a fanatic personality for quality and product. So, and then you had a partner like Murray Klein, who brought intensity and concentration and intellect and a tough, tough personality. Mm. So you put that together, and you can do that. I always used to say, I think we could run General Motors. You know, the same talent could have, not real General Motors, but we could have, you know, you put that talent together, it just happened to land in Zabar's.
Yeah.
And Murray Klein, since he was a Russian immigrant, educated, you know, in Russia, but he didn't aspire, he was too late for him to become a doctor or a lawyer. And Stanley Zabar did become a lawyer and did practice law for a while, but felt the better his talents were better here. And I got married early, I was 21, I got married early, and sort of fell here, never moved out of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was my own boss, who was very comfortable with my own boss. I could, although I worked huge hours, I could come and go as I wanted, although I was a prisoner of the thing. I felt, and I lived down the block on Western Avenue and 81st Street. I lived at 441. I grew up in 219. So it just fell that way.
It was a natural to step in those shoes.
Yeah, and like Bonnie Greengrass, he's on 86th Street, 86, yes, 86. That was also started by the father, and then Bo Greengrass. Then Barney started it. I used to see Barney in the smokehouses. Then Mo came in, and then Gil, and I think another one. So they continued to run that business.
So there's still a few holdouts.
That's the only one I know. Yeah. And then you have Russ and Daughters. There's Russ and Daughters in a historic district.
Uh-huh.
And so they seem to be doing all right.
Yeah, because I think Moishe's is the last bakery. It's, you don't really get a Jewish bakery anymore.
I don't think Moishe's exists anymore. Moishe's.
Did they close? Oh.
Which Moishe's?
Because I know Girdle's closed down. Although they kind of were really...
Moishe's closed down about 5 years ago.
Oh, no.
The Moishe I'm talking about was...
I think they had one on Delancey, and then there was...
Well, we've had a lot of boutique bakers.
Yeah.
The baking industry has had its... for some reason, you can fall in love with bread.
Yeah.
We have Amy's Bread.
Yeah, it's a renaissance.
We have Delancey Street.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of boutique... we have a lot of the boutique bakers. Something about bread... because it's a product, you start here, and you finish here.
Yeah.
It's not like running this store, right? I got 250 people, I got people from all over. I got Russians, I got Chinese, I got Dominicans, I got everything that's done over here, working here.
Well, I bake bread too, as a hobby, and I trained at school for it, but I love it because you don't have a waiter, you don't have a manager like in a restaurant. It's just you, the bread.
Yeah, it's
you,
creative. Yeah.
Yeah, and it really, I don't know, there's like a zen quality to it, you know.
My brother Eli, found an old oven in his restaurant, EAT, and got involved with baking bread. And before he moved to a real bakery, he had a bunch of French-speaking Guianas, people who baked French bread, who were French Island, who grew up working for him in the basement, and then he moved over to his present. He's got a bakery on 91st Street.
I passed it before. Why did your brother not stay with Zabar's here and you guys connected? Why is he on the east side instead of the west side?
He worked here during his college. He went to Columbia, and he didn't flunk out. He got terrible grades or something. So my mother told him, I'm not going to finance, you're going to play around and go to college, I'm not going to finance your education, you're going to have to pay for it yourself. So he went back to general studies, and he worked here at night. You know, as we were open to 12 midnight in those days, so he worked here at night, and when he finished, he says, well, you want me to stay, I got to become a partner. I said, well, wait a second, you got to work here a few years before you can say, I want to see if we can live with you. He says, no, they're not moving out. And he had some money for inheritance, my father. And he worked for some deli people on the east side for a while. He was always an independent spirit. He was a quarterback in his high school football team. He was always a rough and tumble character. So he went to work for some deli people on the east side, and then he worked for a wine retailer. I can't think of his name now. He's still in business. Not Sherry's, but another big guy. And then he had some money he inherited from the estate, and he opened the EAT restaurant. He married a very Abby Zabar, who was an extremely talented designer and so forth, and they built the EAT restaurant on Lexington and 81st Street. And then they opened a deli in the Rhinelander building in down on 72nd Street. That's now... Ralph Lauren's thing, and he sold them his lease for $3 million, which at that time would be like $10 or $12 million now. It would seem like money.
Yeah.
He sold his lease, and then he found the bread thing, he found that in his basement, so then he went, and on the same block with his bakery was his vinegar factory, Baker's Brands, that was closing up, so he bought that piece of property. And then that was the vinegar factory, and then so he went in his own direction.
Yeah.
He originally was a partner with when he was with DAT, when he was MET. He originally opened up. He and his wife designed a little condominium across from Central from Museum of Natural History on, has to be about 78th Street. Industry design and with the son, he was went to school in Dalton. He went the son of Durst family, which is a big builder, Doug Durst. So Doug Durst, and he built that building, and we had a depression at that time, a recession, and they had highly leveraged it. So the Durst family came in and bailed them out, and Doug was left with it. He had to sell his shares. So Doug, so that was his first venture. So that was a venture he did. They designed a condo, which is still in existence, quite beautiful. It's a 5 or 6 story. It was a bunch of walk-ups, a couple of walk-ups. So that's why. He kind of was a maverick. He didn't want to hang around here. There were too many partners, the client, myself. And
yeah.
He wanted to go on his own.
And he processes more things, in a sense, than you're more a purveyor of stuff that's from around the world, and he's really making his product.
Right. We buy his bread.
Uh-huh.
We were his first big customers and his major customer at that time. Now he sells to Costco and Fairway, everybody. You know, everybody buys it. We're important. We were his first major customers when we first started out, because he was at the early, he was a cutting edge. And he produces food like we do. I'm trying to think what else. He makes ice cream. He has an imagine. He's into chocolate. Bread baking on premises.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good, very creative.
And Murray Klein was
he's a European, more European.
Sorry. Murray Klein, he brought the idea of the gourmet, the upstairs where you sell equipment and stuff, or whose idea was that?
That was his.
Uh-huh.
He'd been in the, remember I told you he was a manager for me in the 96th Street store,
right.
And he decided to go to the hardware business.
Mm-hmm.
He went to hardware, and he had a love of this kind of stuff, hardware stuff, or durable goods, what he thought. And he then went off, he left me to go into the hardware business. He had a small hardware store. And so when he came back with a desire to create this business. And the first place that he did it was in the corner where we have our cafe now. That was was called Ware's Fair, W-A-R-E-S, Ware's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so he set up this selection of some stuff from I forget who it was, and then eventually we were renovating these buildings, so it was his decision, his desire to make the second floor a housewares, cookware department, so forth, and we did. We were premier suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
We were a major supplier on the west side. Now you have Gracious Home,
mm-hmm.
that moved from the east side over to 63rd Street, so we do have that competition here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our big competition has been the web. you can, I believe, because we don't do the business that we do, we don't do business now that we did 20 years ago, when they, 20 or somewhat, 30 years ago, when they, 20 somewhat years ago, when they started this thing.
Does that include the food business as well, or?
The food business, we do more business.
Right.
Our products are not easily available in the market. You get some smoked salmon, you're going to pay $40, $50, $60 a pound.
Yeah, who knows what's going to happen to it in the mail.
No, they ship it probably. Yeah. They ship it. But that's harder to do.
Yeah.
Prepared foods, the prepared foods that we develop, that's hard to do in the market. You can do them, it's hard. The salmon products, that's hard. The cheese, that's easier, but it's still hard. You know, the varieties and this, that, so. But the one item that you can get, if you want to get a food processor and you surf the web, I'm sure you'll find what you want. If you know the modeling, know what you want, I'm sure you'll find it easily, and they'll ship it to you and so forth. So I think that's what's, I think that has affected us. We do less business now than we did 10, 15 years ago.
And how do you think your competition has changed you? I mean, you have... Whole Foods now, Trader Joe's, there's Fairway. Are you trying to change Zabar's, or are you going to, I don't know, are you going to expand Zabar's? Are you going to make it even bigger? Are you going to try to make it?
Zabar's, that's the only way Zabar's going to stand is through its internet business.
Uh-huh.
It is now doing a substantial internet business. We ship perishables overnight. It's expensive, but we can ship them anywhere in the United States. To expatriate New Yorkers, we send the same products that we have here. We're not shipping a lot of prepared foods. We're shipping smoked salmon. I don't know exactly. You know, the coffee is a very shippable item. But smoked salmon is shippable. You have to look at our website, and we just have a new catalog out. I don't know if I have it here. We just have a spring catalog, but basically, it's giftware.
Uh-huh.
It's essentially it's gift items, baskets, what we call baskets, gift boxes, is predominantly predominantly what we're showing.
Okay. And who's going to be the next generation of Zabar's?
Well, my daughter Annie was working here. That she told me today that she's been here 14 years, and she says she wants to move on. So she bought a house. She hasn't bought a house in Chappaqua. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think we're going to lose her. For the time being, she was responsible for the development of the web business.
Uh-huh.
My son Aaron is front manager. Uh-huh. He went to culinary school. When he came here, he found himself in the kitchen, and then he wasn't happy, and he moved on to front end management. So he's in the front end.
Right.
My cousin Larry is the computer expert. My cousin Andrea just got married. My cousin Andrea is our graphics person and did this catalog.
Right.
She's upstairs. Cousin Andrea's upstairs, and we do all the graphics here, and we do all the putting together the catalog ourselves, and we just send it. What we do, it goes to the printer from here. Mm-hmm. So we created that catalog and any other catalogs that I may have around, which I don't have any. And we have them downstairs. We just got a new catalog. But it's essentially a gift catalog,
right?
And with a special section of smoked salmon and some cakes that we specialize in, like Rogaloch and chocolate babkas and so forth. We don't have fresh fish, which Fairway has, and Cinderella has. We don't have fresh meats, which they do. We have a little of that stuff, but not much. They have a full variety of that. Fairway's really a super supermarket.
Yeah,
with everything, and still carries some of it. Still does some deli business, and he has some prepared foods, and big produce, of course.
Right.
They start in produce, like no other market is. Cinderella is basically meat and fresh fish, and the prepared foods are not much, at least on the west side, because they have some east side stores. Fairway has moved out to Plainview, and he's up 125th Street. He's been very successful, and also they went one at Red Hook.
Mm-hmm.
And they've opened. D'Agostino, I don't see doing much. Used to be one on Broadway next to
I think they've shut down a lot of their stores.
Well, maybe they have.
Yeah.
The Food Emporium, we have one on 90th Street. I'm not too excited about that food emporium.
Yeah.
They knew how to operate. They could do, if I were operating that business, I could do double the business they did.
Yeah.
And I tell them all the time, I could, you put one cashier when you need five. Well, the manager says, please call my boss, tell him that. They give you an amount of money, what they call it, and you can't exceed it. So if he wants to have five cashiers, he can't have money.
Yeah.
So we go in there, you got lines of people. I have 9 or 10 cashiers going here. When I walk up there in the evening, maybe they have 1 or 2 people. I mean, it's a fabulous location, but they just applied the rules of limitations, of financial limitations to that.
And sometimes expanding isn't a good idea because you can really lose control, I guess, right?
I had my taste of markets. I ran 5 markets on Broadway from 900 Tenth Street down to 80th Street. I wasn't successful in any of them. I didn't have good control. Mm. I wasn't sophisticated enough to do it. Mm. And I had my taste of that. And after 8 years of that, I decided that I would stay in one place and make it go, make it work. And now with the internet, I can be anywhere. I can be all over the world if I want to. So I can do whatever I want.
And you're not only known in New York, you're an icon, I think, around the world, really. I mean, who hasn't heard of Zabar's? So,
they're all over the place, yeah.
What is Zabar's? What's your description of your store? What can you tell me is Zabar's to you?
Well, I'm not, unfortunately or fortunately, I'm not looking from the outside looking in.
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking from the inside looking out.
Uh-huh.
So the only thing I can say is we have some, that we are a big family in a sense, although predominantly Dominican. When we had the Russian immigration, when the communists, so we had some Jewish, we had some people, a couple remained. We had Chinese people from the around the corner. We had things that cleans clothes, with Chinese people, Chinese laundry. And their kids worked here, and then their relatives came over. So we have a few left. In fact, this gentleman here worked 25 years, retired.
Wow.
I don't know what year he retired, and gave him a farewell party and gold watch. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's whatever he gave. Yeah. We have a retirement program here that 15% of your salary goes into your retirement program.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a 401k.
Right.
Except it's circle the money, but the employees don't put anything to it. And you get it when you say, let's say I had to start cleaning mine out. The accountant just called me that I had to take out $100,000. I must have $2 million there by this time. My accountant called, $1.5 million. My accountant called me to say I took out $100,000 last year and gave it to a charity. Did I do the same this year? Because if I took it in my pocket, I pay 50% taxes, so I'm still in a high tax bracket.
Sure.
So whenever I have to take out of my retirement, I immediately give it to a charitable organization, of which we are many. We are involved with Symphony Space. I don't know if you know them.
Mm-hmm.
On 95th Street. We are a supporter of their 2007, 2006 programming. We gave them $250,000, Zabar's. And now the JCC over here, which I don't know if on 76th Street is a fabulous operation. Are you familiar with that?
No.
They built that about 6 years ago. Wonderful gymnasiums and health club and facilities. They have preschool and schools. People fighting to get in. There's a shortage of places and so forth. So we gave them $5 million. Personally, we gave them over 5 years. So I'll give them $1 million a year. To support them, and Zabar's gives them $250,000 a year to support their programming. So that's where we are now. As I say, unfortunately, my daughter told me today that she's moving to buy a house. I knew she was buying a house in Chattanooga. She told me that. She said she wants to go up there and be full time up there. She has 2 children by a current marriage, and so we are trying to support the neighborhood, and any organization comes to us with donation, usually it's $25, $50, whatever it is, they'll give it to the schools. All the schools here get donations from us. We are working But any organization that meets, that comes to us and has some resonance in the area, we work with, we support them.
Right.
And that's what we do. I mean, that's it's my brother Stanley, who is here part-time. He's here 2 or 3 days a week, a couple days a week. And myself, do I have any other cousins here? my son now, my girls, my daughter just now, my cousin, a couple of cousins.
Will you be able to bring her back? Will you convince her?
I'm hoping. She developed the internet business.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason she felt she wasn't really raising her children. Because, you know, she was here from 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock. So maybe she'll come back.
Just change her hours.
She can have any hours she wants.
Yeah.
But she's been commuting now from Chappaqua. Mm. So right now she's got to get... They bought a big house. So they've got to set the house up. And maybe I'll get her back in the summer. Maybe she'll get tired of
the kids.
Doing yoga. Maybe she'll get tired of doing yoga.
Yeah.
So then we'll get her back. Who else can we have here? Well, a lot of people we have here, because of... The type, we get very entry level, a lot of entry level people, a lot of them don't speak very good English.
Sure.
And so they tend to stay with us because they don't have real educations. Mm-hmm. They're usually recommended, one group is recommending another.
Sure.
So we get most of our people come, are interrelated. So there's a lot of interrelated cousins and
sure.
so forth working here, non-Jewish.
Yeah.
Non-Jewish. And so. And they tend to stay with us because they're not getting training that will allow them to work in a doctor's office mm-hmm. or to do, you know, the training they get here, we put them in, take them to another market, so it's better. So we have people staying with us 15, 20, 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
Boris, my chef, is here 30 some odd years. I'm here 57 years, 58 years, 58 years. So those people tend to stay.
Yeah.
So we have a very solid, we don't have a lot of
turnover
in personnel. Uh-huh. Hey, Kenny. Okay. I'll see you later. Yeah. Kenny's Chinese. He's American Chinese. He found his way here. When he got married, down in Chinatown.
Uh-huh.
Went down his family, of course. Those people in English. So that group tends to stay with us.
Right.
And any of the really intelligent group then moves on. So we've populated places like Food, Fresh Direct, you know, some of the top people have gone into
different
up at the higher echelons of
yeah.
places. So we've populated some of those places.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe half a dozen of those
sure.
people have gone on. And so we're very stable. We're stable here. There's always cashiers moving on. Cashiers, most of the people that move around most are cashiers because they tend to be somewhat part-time. We have a lot of full-time. Tend to be somewhat part-time with children, without fathers,
right.
you know, whose parents are raising their, when they're working or something. So the cashiers tend to rotate, to move on. But there's a handful that stayed here. And up here in the mezzanine, we also tend to get people that stay with us because of their level, educational
right.
level, economic level, so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Yeah, I noticed that there's a lot of Dominicans here because my sous chef is Dominican and my breakfast cook at work is Dominican and they're pretty loyal guys. So
my executive chef or my chef speaks kitchen Spanish
yeah.
very well.
Yeah.
He can hold a conversation
yeah.
with his, because they're all Dominicans
sure.
or I don't know, we have one, we just got one, we're friends of this fellow runs the Scandinavian restaurant. Marcus
Amundsen.
Marcus Amundsen, yeah.
yeah.
So, because he's part of CCAP, we're very big contributors to CCAP.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you're familiar with CCAP.
No.
CCAP started 7 years ago. Started by this guy who was a Cordon Bleu trained chef.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, he was not made for the kitchen, so he wrote a book about cooking. And he decided to create a curriculum for high school students.
Mm-hmm.
Of Latinos, you know, and somewhat disadvantaged,
right.
going to trade school,
sure.
going to trade schools, a great curriculum to prepare them to enter the culinary field.
Mm.
So we started, it has to be 5, 6, 7 years ago, but we started, I wasn't very optimistic. They started this thing, And he started a place, one of his main places was a place called Park West High School. It's on 64th to 65th Street.
Uh-huh.
When you go into Park West, you got to go to a metal detector.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of high school it is. And my wife, when she was a juvenile prosecutor for the city of New York, said she had a substantial number of clients that she got from Park West High School.
Yeah.
and so forth. So he started that program. It was a vocational high school that had been built for culinary, for the culinary field.
Mm.
For that, and also for aeronautical repairs or whatever it is. And so he started the curriculum. It is spread throughout the five boroughs and his curriculum, and he does it without fee. He raises money through galas and through contributions from people like myself. And they trained hundreds and hundreds of these kids to become interns in restaurants.
Right.
He's produced all the cannon fodder that goes into these, you know, these young people going, and he's gotten, I would say, hundreds what do you call it? Not free schooling, what do they call it? Where you go to Godson and Wales on a scholarship.
Right.
He's gotten to donate hundreds of scholarships during the course of the year. Now, a scholarship to Johnson Wales is worth $30,000 to $40,000
sure.
a year.
Yeah.
When you finish with Johnson Wales, you come out with owing money. It takes you 10 years to pay you off that debt. When people come out of Johnson & Wales, one of those things, they say, what was I thinking? Because you come out with $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth of debt. You don't have to pay them back. You know, I have one guy here who, we have a program here that is, someone's really in trouble, we lend them money,
mm-hmm.
you know, without interest. First of all, if anybody here or any of their offspring is going to school, we pay a third of their tuition.
Right.
But we also have another program that if you, for some reason, have overextended your credit card, you know, something, you made a mistake, and because we don't want them to go to the money lenders, because Dominicans have a history of using money lenders. It goes back to their country.
Sure.
They think it's, and these are loan sharks.
Yeah.
They get 10%, you pay 10% or 5% a week, and you never pay off the principal.
Yeah.
And they consider that to be, that's the way it always was. That's the way it was in the Dominican Republic.
Sure.
So when they're short of money or they make them, or they overreach themselves, they go to these loan sharks. And I have to send out letters that do not go to the loan sharks, come to us. Because once they get hooked into a loan shark, they can never get free.
Yeah.
They're always borrowing. You know, they are hooked for life because they never have to pay off the principal. So we have a program here that anybody who really gets into trouble comes to, and we try to give them, they pay us $50 or $100 a week or something like that,
okay.
and they liquidate. So, I'm off on a tangent. So this guy developed his curriculums. He's gotten all these big schools to give him scholarships. And that's why we know Marcus Samuelson.
Yeah.
Marcus Samuelson is very active in this organization.
Sure.
Because I guess he feels being, he's Ethiopian.
Yeah.
Ethiopian. And he grew up in
Sweden.
Sweden.
Yeah.
So the reason I'm telling you the story is I called him about 6 months ago, 5 months ago. I said, I need somebody from the kitchen. You got any particular reference? I said, yeah, I'll send you somebody. He sent me this Ethiopian. It was lovely, lovely Ethiopian. I got a guy working in the kitchen. I said, all Dominicans, now I got an Ethiopian for a change.
Yeah.
He doesn't speak any Spanish, but I got one guy in the kitchen that doesn't speak Spanish, and he's an Ethiopian. He's a marvelous guy.
Uh-huh.
And he loves to play soccer. And I had to give an agreement that on days when his soccer team is playing, I had to get more. He's a first-grade soccer player,
yeah.
He tells me. Yeah. So...
If you weren't Saul Zabar working at Zabar's, who would you be today if you had gone to college and finished that?
I didn't finish college.
Uh-huh.
I never graduated. Didn't finish where I was going to. If I hadn't done that, I'd be a doctor today.
Uh-huh.
If I hadn't done that, I would have gone to medicine. I like it because I like science. I like the way, the body is a scientific experiment. Constantly, you know, ever changing.
Right.
It involved all the things that I was interested in. So I'd be in some form of medicine, I believe.
Right.
That's what I would do. When I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be a farmer. Because I think farmers, they grow things, they live. I had no idea what the economics of being a farmer was.
Yeah.
So I've done like that. And I always had gardens when I was a kid. We have a place, a Mohegan Colony, which is near Peekskill.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I grew up in summers. So we made a garden there. And I said, I think I'd like to be a farmer. Then when I went to school, I was going to get pre-med. I was going to do that. And then I came back here when my father died. And I went back to general studies to finish my degree once. And I was like, what am I doing? And study English Lit. I got to get my requisite English Lit. I take an art history course. And then what am I doing? So I never did finish that.
My last question would be, what would you like to do on your days off, if you have any?
I do have days off.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if I'm in the city, I'm here every day.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't mean I have to be a full day. In other words, I'd be here Monday through Friday, those are full days. Yesterday, when I got here late, I only got about 10 o'clock yesterday, and I was here. Here for the most part, and for most of the day, I can't remember what happened yesterday. Here for the most part, and today, I slept late, and I went over to. We have a friend from Israel coming, and then I went over to see them. It's about 10-ish, and they said, "Oh, we're having brunch at 11." So I came over here, and then I did the brunch thing with them, and then I came from there. I came here.
Yeah.
So if I were on a Saturday and Sunday, I would be here, and then I could go to a museum, I could go to the JCC, I could do, I can otherwise use this as kind of a pit stop, and then do whatever else I want to go to a museum. And I'd call my wife, come on, we'll walk through the park, let's go to the Met, we'll take the scenes till we get the Met.
But you're never too far.
Yeah, no, I never move out too far from this. There's so much to do and see here.
Yeah.
I never do that. I don't go to the movies.
Uh-huh.
I say to my wife, I don't want to sit in the dark place. I've seen it on television. She runs an Israeli film festival.
Uh-huh.
It's called the Other Film Festival. She ran that for the first time last year. She brought up, she selected the films. She had the film, she had a director of the film festival. They called the Other Film Festival, and they ran it in three theaters in the city, 95th Street. And then the JCC and going downtown. It's called the Other Film Festival. It had to do with Arab Israeli citizens, their lives in the way they live their lives in Israel through film. But nothing political, but just through their, sociological
support. Right.
So she does that. She's, I told you, she's a lawyer. She worked for the city in juvenile prosecution. That place. And she's running this 2 years. She's busy with a film festival, selecting films for him. She's got a publicity agent. She's got a director. She's got the use of the JCC has a film program, so she gets the use of his time, and she runs her funds through JCC, so he's paid. He runs it as a contribution.
Mm-hmm.
She's paid through JDP. So she does that. My children are grown, as they say. I got a daughter that lives in Los Angeles. She wants to be a film. She wants to be a writer of sitcoms.
Uh-huh.
So she's busy writing sitcoms. She's very comfortable. She has her own money, that which we gave her, and that which she had invested for her. She's very comfortable. So she's living in Los Angeles. Although I heard from someone that she said this is the year that she wants to get, she's 36, that she wants to get married, have a baby, so maybe she'll find some unlucky guy for that.
Yeah.
So that's doing that. I have no plans for myself. I have a house in Florida that I go down to every few weeks. I go down on a Thursday afternoon and come back on a Monday morning. So I do get that.
A little fishing or swimming? Or
no, there's no, we don't swim. Yeah. But I have a house, and my daughter and her husband and children have a house near us.
Uh-huh.
And her brother, my wife's brother, who's a neurologist, has a house in the same area.
Yeah.
At Lighthouse Point. It's just a little south of Boca. It's really a white-collar community. It was a white-collar community that's been overrun by people building large houses on the canals.
Uh-huh.
But right near the intercoastal, in the summertime, we have a house in Fire Island.
Mm-hmm.
So I go about a Friday. I can leave on a Friday morning. And I'll be there Friday, Saturday, come back either Sunday or Monday morning. So I have, in the summertime, I have that. So I'm not a workaholic, but I get here usually around 9 o'clock and I leave at 6.
Yeah.
And when I go to the Acme, so I go up here, I'm here about 7:30. I go once I must go, on Wednesdays, I must go there. And if there's problems, I go on Thursday. If not, I send my assistant. He goes there Mondays and Tuesdays to select the fish that we have sliced for us for our packages.
Right.
All the fish that goes into our Zabar packages is pre-approved by us to select by us. And it's done to our specifications.
Well, look, I'd love to go and see that, down there with you one day.
So he goes there Mondays and Tuesdays. Wednesdays, I'm there all the time. Thursdays, I go if there's really a problem. And there's another smokehouse the son of the owner runs it now. It's called Service. That I used to deal with his father for many, many years. All the others, the Marshall is closed. All the rest are closed now. Maybe there's something. Oh, the Banner. We deal with the Banner on Coney Island.
Mm.
But he's primarily for religious. He deals with the more Orthodox Jews. He has a more a higher level of kashrut, of kosher than we do.
Sure.
Than the guys we do. They have Kuf K or something like that. He has the real, so he gets that. So we deal with him a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Kippitzer, we buy some Kippitzer. We buy our herring from Newfoundland, which we still have it shipped in twice a year from Newfoundland. The fillets.
Right. So the smoked fish and the coffee are your two babies then?
I've always done that. And prior, when we were in the fresh meat business, when we had the other market, so I was the meat buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And produce, I never did produce. Produce, so we always had a produce buyer. That required being up early and going to the produce market.
Yeah.
So we always had a produce buyer. When we had the other markets, the meat, I used to be going. There used to be Fairway is now, 125th Street was called, it was a small meat market. It was called Little West, something like West, the meat market. And it was an offshoot of the one down on 14th Street.
Right, right. The old market down there.
The old market. But they had other, it was a full-fledged market up here. It was under
the highway, yeah.
The highway, yeah. And the buildings there, the Fairway building now, was the old Swift plant.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore, when you go into the plant, they don't have refrigerated cases. They refrigerate the entire area.
Yeah.
Give it up there.
I went there when they first opened because I almost tried to get a job there.
Yeah.
And I just kind of saw what they were putting together and just.
But the entire building was refrigerated when it was a Swift plant, and so they instead of putting individual refrigeration, they just continued to refrigerate. So they give you a jacket when you go into the meat area.
Wow.
They give you a coat to wear, so that you can buy, and the meat is just laid out. I mean, maybe the refrigeration works, but the general atmosphere.
I think Western Beef has something like that, too, where they have a cold area just for the meat.
Yeah, they have that. So we had Swift. B. Rosen, I think, is still down there. I think there's one company that remained there. Westside Poultry used to be there. Now they're in the West Hall Market.
Yeah.
B. Rosen, I think, stayed. We used to buy veal from them, veal and lamb.
Yeah.
Swift is out. Armour, I don't think, had a presence there. And then there were some independents that were there. So I used to go up there to buy the meat. And then I would get in my car and go down to Brooklyn, use the West Side Highway, pick up the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. So I'd go buy fish. So I've always been doing outside. And then before our cheese department became sophisticated, I used to buy certain cheese on the outside. I used to go looking for certain cheese that I thought were. But then, as it became more sophisticated, so Aldo, the cheese buyer now, basically does we import some stuff from France we share a container with another importer.
Well, my wife says it's the best cheese department in New York, so I can't argue with her because I always come for my Cypress Grove cheese or.
I don't know Cypress Grove.
It's the Humboldt Farm.
Yeah.
And then you have a couple other ones that I always come in for because I love my goat and sheep cheese. It's always good.
It's become far more sophisticated. When I first started, Shredder Importer was the Ile de France was the major French label.
Yeah. Now that's Président and all these other companies.
President. Yeah. But now, at that time, we were able to get Brie cheese that was made from unpasteurized milk.
Yeah.
Still were able to get until a few years ago.
Yeah.
Sort of sneak it in occasionally. And that's really delicious. This stuff that we get now tastes like, I don't know, blah.
Yeah.
But the real Brie, when it comes from unpasteurized milk, is unbelievable.
Have you considered buying from the farmers directly? Like in the farmer's market, I've found some incredible cheeses direct. I mean, it's more expensive, but you're getting it directly from the farmer rather than buying it from the middle guy.
We do buy something.
Yeah.
We buy from some co-ops. Well, Cabot Creamery is a co-op.
Yeah.
But we do buy from some boutique producers in Vermont.
Right.
And there is a cheese, the Grafton, Vermont, is a cheese course, or there's a cheese facility there that offers a course to beginning cheese makers. Go up there and take you work in the plant, craft it a lot. So we do buy a fairly substantial amount of cheese from boutique producers.
Yeah, because there's the places out in Jersey that I've found like really great cheese, like Bobo Link Farms, I think. He even makes bread out there, and there are these little artisanal guys, you know. So
yeah. We do buy directly from somebody. I'm out of the loop. That's Olga's department.
Uh-huh.
And she's here, so almost 30 years.
Wow.
And she basically runs, when I first started, it was Swiss cheese and Emmentaler. And,
yeah.
I mean, I used to go out and look for aged something I like. I like the particular cheese. I'd go look, see who had the best product. But now I don't do anything with cheese except taste it. But when they put it out, they always put out something to taste. We bake our own bread now.
We have
a very nice rye bread, fabulous rye bread that we're baking now. It's unbelievable. I don't think there's anything like it.
And where are you producing that here in
right in here?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'll give you one point. Wow. We have. I think that's. We just stumbled on that, and I think that's the best thing, the best bread that we sell here, and we sell now about 1,600 pieces a week for that.
Well, I'm gonna have to make you one of my breads so you can try mine and see what you think.
This is totally different. This is a rye bread with seeds, with caraway seeds, and they're very crusty.
Yeah.
It's a kind of rye.
Yeah.
An interesting thing. There was a. Bittman did a recipe about a year ago, 2 years ago, in the Times on baking, a bread recipe, which...
The no need.
Right.
Yep.
I
talked to Jim Leahy about that.
Yeah. Was it Jim Leahy? It wasn't Bittman?
No, it's Jim Leahy. Bittman kind of went over and talked. But there's a little bit of controversy with that recipe, too. Because a few people have told me that, it's been done for a long time, because I was in Wales this summer with Dan Lepard.
No, this has been doing it. But it totally
took off.
Contradicts all the rules of rising and kneading, and the dough is to be wet as you possibly can do it. You put it wet into
12
the oven.
Hours. Then into a Creuset pot, which is burning hot, and then you burn your hands. But I've done it at home, and it actually has come out pretty nice, actually. Surprising.
One of my friend of mine is a cardiologist, and his wife is a bread baker.
Uh-huh.
And he's always buying stones. Put in the oven,
right?
You know? So his wife said she made it, and she said it was good. You know, you don't pump it, you don't let it rise and pump it and hit it down again.
Yeah.
You just put it and let it go, and
then you throw it in,
put in the oven. Yeah,
yeah. There's a little bit less control, but it's interesting. It's a different method. Yeah.
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 You don't flour the dough. You don't have something you're working with. It's a gloppy mess.
Yeah.
And it makes it, they tell me it produces a good loaf of bread.
It has a nice crust on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depends what kind of bread you like, too. I mean, I love, like, German bread and stuff. I mean, I'm born there.
You like those hard...
I like the real good rye breads, real grains.
Grain, graining breads,
yeah.
Yeah, we're working on baking some of that stuff,
yeah.
But we're not too successful. My brother Eli makes a very nice, they call it seven grain or whatever.
Yeah.
Very nice bread. I've never tried it. It's his health bread. He calls it health bread.
Right.
It's got in it. He's got some kind of seeds.
Sunflower
seeds. Yeah. It gives you something. It's great.
Yeah, like in German, they call them Vollkornbrot. So they're like the real hearty grains in there. But they're really good for you, too. It's a different palate, I think, than the wheat bread. So.
But this is a very a good crossover from the German style. Of this heavy, dark,
Pumpernickel,
malty kind of bread thing, to a, it's called, he calls it his health bread.
Uh-huh.
And it slices thin if you want to slice it, and it's really good. It's a good,
yeah,
really first class product. Yeah.
Well, so. I appreciate it, Mr. Zabar. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. It's wonderful getting all the history, and even the tangents are good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've done here. Yeah, you see, we do demos every weekend. We have people demoing things.
Well, what I always find a pleasure at Zabar's is trying to get through the crowds of people. Yeah. And always saying, oh, they need a traffic light here to get people through.
They're too crowded. The aisles seem to get narrow every year. They put too much stuff out.
But it's sort of an experience, you know, getting the nutty New Yorkers and then the tourists and then just, you know, I want to get this.
Fairway is crazy.
I
don't think I could survive Fairway as a customer. It's
yeah.
so crazy. But I guess the momentum carries you along. You know, you're forced to go to the checkouts.
Yeah.
It's like a river of forcing you through the store.
Sure.
Yeah. This is
it's an institution, my wife said.
It is an institution in the sense that we've promoted ourselves all over the world. We sell a coffee mug for $1. T-shirt for $3.99.
Well, this is where I got my first copper pots as a budding chef.
I think we're discontinuing our copper
pots.
One time it was a very big, we bring it in Mobile from France.
Well, it's hard to get them lined, retinned, you know, so there's less people doing it.
Now it's stainless steel lined.
Yeah, well, I've got some of the old ones with the old tin, but.
With the tin. And there are still some people tinning. There are still people doing tinning for you. But someone buys it. And they bring it back, they put too much heat on it, they bring it back, and they melted the tin.
The tin away, yeah.
Yeah, and they say, this is no good, this is not effective. What am I going to tell them that you did not use it? But now I think the big thing is this copper with the stainless steel
yeah. Yeah.
And I think, except for the restaurants, people don't want to buy those things.
Yeah.
We used to sell a lot of it to the restaurants.
They do cook really well, though.
Yeah.
It's a really nice instrument to use,
quite
yeah.
different than...
Oh, yeah.
Because now we have sandwich... pots that have three different metals, you know, aluminum and
steel,
and copper. You know, they do sandwich. They make sandwiches.
Yeah.
So you still find the copper is your.
Well, I love it, but it's got tin in it. You better be careful not to eat the copper, because it's not good for you. I do love the cast iron pans too, like the Lodge that you guys carry. Those are really good. Yeah.
Although copper, once they're for whites of eggs, for fluffy whites.
Oh yeah,
eggs,
great.
Copper is. The best.
Yeah, it's a conductor of making them really come up nice.
I think there's an electrolytic action between the
copper.
There's a chemical reaction between the whites and the copper that does that.
Something with the albumin and the right. copper like each other.
There's something that goes on there.
Well, right. Thanks again.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Let's see, I got 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, I got to start working on my orders. So now I'm...